Great, let's get this party started. I am David, and I'm a bookseller here at Literati. Thank you for joining us this evening. This is our first year returning to a full event schedule of in-store events since our temporary closure in March of 2020. Between then and resuming in-store events in August of last year, we've hosted hundreds of virtual events and a few special ticketed off-site events. You can browse our archive of virtual events on YouTube. Just search Literati Bookstore and find information about our upcoming events at literatibookstore.com. And tonight, Literati is pleased to partner with the University of Michigan Sweetland Center for Writing and WCBN Radio for the latest installment of Writer to Writer with Shelley Manis.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight. My name is Shelley Manis, as you know, and I'm on the faculty at the Sweetland Center for Writing. At Sweetland, we often say simply, we talk to writers. And that's the basis of this series and the basis of the journal run by Sweetland's minor in writing students of the same name, which is that we are writers who talk to other writers about what we do, and hopefully someone will get something out of that. I want to thank our co-sponsors, Literati, Best Place in Ann Arbor, maybe Best Place in Michigan, if you ask me, and WCBN for co-sponsoring us. That's so wonderful, and we're really glad to be back. Let's talk to our guests. I'm going to read their bios, just because that is a lovely thing to do and hear about their accomplishments. And may I just say that these bios are incredibly clipped because of the space on our poster when we had two people, so they are much more than what we're saying here. But Ashley Lucas teaches theater at the University of Michigan, where she also serves as the director of the Latino Studies Program and the former director of the Prison Creative Arts Project. Her book, Prison Theater and the Global Crisis of Incarceration, describes the ways that incarcerated theater makers use performance to change their lives. Phil Christman is a lecturer, fellow lec, in English at the University of Michigan, and the author of Midwest Futures, which I also can't wait to read, and How to Be Normal, essays. So without further ado, this is, as I think I said, the first time that I've ever had two guests, and it's absolutely the first time I've ever had two guests that were married to one another. So this is really exciting for me. They're, full disclosure, they're also good friends. So could you just start out and each of you maybe tell us your favorite thing about your current books? This is hard for Phil because he likes to be self-deprecating, but
yeah. About my current book. Well, okay, the marriage essay is quite good. So How to Be Normal is a collection of essays that, the title kind of gives it away. It's like, I found myself in this weird position where I kept writing essays, where I, analyzed topics that had, an air of, banality about them. Like the first thing that I wrote that anybody cared about was about being Midwestern, which, you know, the generic American, right? And then the second thing I wrote that anybody cared about was about being male. And then I ended up, writing about, being, having grown up fundamentalist, which is very banal in America. I mean, demographically speaking. And so then it just kind of seemed like, okay, I'm the guy who writes about stuff that seems too boring to analyze. That's my niche now. So what else is in my life is like that? Well, I'm a heterosexual man who's married to a woman. That fits. And I'm really proud of how that essay turned out, frankly. It's nice to have one of the best things you write be something that like makes your wife look cool. It's nice to give.
It really does.
It's nice to give that gift to somebody close to you. So I actually do like that a lot about that book.
Well, I might be more well known as the subject of Phil Christman's marriage essay than I am for anything that I've written myself. But my book, Prison Theater and the Global Crisis of Incarceration, is about prison theater troupes, incarcerated theater makers in 13 different countries around the globe, and how their work is really changing the experience of being in prison, but also changing the minds of the people who get to see that theater about what prison is and does and who belongs in prison and what it takes to be an artist and what the arts mean.
Oh, that's so exciting. I can't wait to read both of those.
I do want to break in and say about Ashley's book and her profile as a writer. She's a huge deal among leftists all over Latin America, particularly Uruguay and Brazil. If you do prison stuff in Uruguay and Brazil, like she's been translated into Portuguese. You know, it's like David Hasselhoff being really huge in Japan, but good.
Ashley, you have a massive audience. Did you ever think you would be compared to David Hasselhoff?
I did not. I've not heard that one before, so that's really exciting. But actually, it's my mother likes to tell people that I'm only famous in prison and Latin America. So,
I'm wondering, what is it like being a two writer and two teacher household? How do your writing lives and your teaching lives interact with each other?
Well, I think that living with another writer and living with another teacher makes me a better version of both of those things, because Phil is a very thoughtful writer and a really good teacher. And the fact that we can talk about those things together, that I see his practice firsthand, Phil is very committed to being a writer and to dedicating time to his writing. In fact, when we first started dating, he was really afraid that I was going to try to take away his writing time, that I wouldn't understand that he needed that, because apparently past girlfriends had had an issue with wanting more of his time. And I was like, that's great. I need to write too. This is wonderful. And he's the best editor I've ever met. And so it pays to sleep with your editor sometimes, because he gives more attention to my work than to anybody else's. And it's an incredibly fast turnaround when I'm anxious about something. He doesn't want me to be anxious anymore. He wants me to feel like what I wrote is going to work, even if it's not working now. And he's really good at helping me figure out how to make that happen. So I feel really blessed. And I told all my friends in grad school and ever since that if you want to have a great career as a tenure track professor, it's a great idea to marry a really handsome editor.
Or if you can't get a really handsome editor, me.
You're taken, Phil.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I'm off the market. I would agree with what Ashley said about feeling like you're a better version of the thing that you're trying to be. Ashley has, I was thinking about this on the way to school today. Like, Ashley and I have different strengths as both writers and teachers. I mean, this is getting a little bit specific, but Ashley having, you know, theater training and being a theater artist, as well as in my opinion, a really excellent writer. Please, by the way, please buy her prison theater book. The ebook is really reasonably priced, and it got published by an academic press, and so it got buried, and it's so readable. People look at it and it just looks unreadable because it comes from Bloomsbury. And that's why it looks unreadable. It's give it the 5-page sniff test. You will be hooked. It is as rigorous as an academic book needs to be, but it does not read like an academic book. There's a person writing it. Like it drives me nuts that academic presses don't do more to promote stuff. But we have different and somewhat complementary skill sets. I feel like I'm a better writing teacher because I have the whole world of theater pedagogy is available to me through her. I mean, Shelley, your opinion about this would be interesting because you have feet in both of those worlds too, like theater and rec comp. But I feel like theater makers, people who teach theater they have this really rich lore of like ways of getting people involved in the art form right away and immediately, like, you know, doing theater games from day one and shedding inhibitions, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like that's easier for writing teachers to overlook. And so I feel like I've benefited from her example there. I also think like my own writing practice is very cerebral and like, I'm very good at doing a ton of research and crunching a bunch of stuff together. Ashley is such a good interviewer. She's so good at actually going out and talking to other human beings and like generating knowledge from that. And I feel like I learn a lot from, you're also better at writing dialogue in almost inevitably because you're a playwright. So I feel like you have strengths in areas that where I'm undeveloped, and hopefully, you know, I have strengths in areas if there are any where you're undeveloped. So that's a nice combination, and I think both. I feel like neither of us really lets ego get in the way. Neither of us is invested in like beating the other or, one of us being a realer writer or artist than the other or any of that kind of nonsense. We both really want the other person to succeed at whatever they're doing. And I think that's pretty helpful.
That's pretty amazing. That makes me want to go out and find myself a writer partner because yeah. It sounds like you've got it made. Would you mind to talk to us a little bit about your writing process, like what that looks like? And I imagine there's some areas of overlap, but I imagine also differences given that a lot of your work, like Phil said, is interview based, or a lot of your research, I should say, is interview based. What are your processes like?
I don't want to go ahead because I don't know what my process is like.
I could tell your process and you could tell mine.
Ooh, that's fun.
Actually, let's do that. Yeah.
Okay, so Phil reads like other people breathe. He reads all the time. He reads very promiscuously from all different genres, all different walks of life. One of the things I really love about Phil is that he speaks the classics of almost any discipline. He has a handle on what they are and what's in them, even if he hasn't read all of them, but he's also read very diversely. He's read big chunks of the Mahabharata and classic Greek and Roman literature. He's constantly studying other languages to try to get a handle on where cultural traditions and literature come from. But he also takes very seriously the voices of people who have not been recognized as major writers. He is the editor of the Michigan Review of Prisoner Creative Writing, and it's been very important for both of us that our work be readable and accessible to working class people and to people in prison, people who don't see themselves often as having access to the kinds of literature that we were raised on. And so Phil reads and reads and reads and reads. And it's really helpful for me because when I'm looking for a concept or a citation or something, I just say to Phil, oh, where did that come from? And he knows it off the top of his head. He's almost autistic in that sense. He can cite things out of the air and be correct about them almost all the time, which is amazing. It's so useful when you're doing research to have him like in the next room to run over and bother when I need something. And he's very gracious about letting me bother him that way. And he always thinks what he's writing is a total failure until it's published and other people think it's good. So even when it goes off to press, he thinks this is awful. Nobody's going to like it. Nobody's going to read it. I'm going to fall on my face. All of my friends are going to think that I'm no good anymore. They're going to think that the last thing I wrote was the best thing I ever wrote, and now this is terrible.
He's peaked.
And I can't talk him out of it except to say this is what you say every single time. And then really smart people who we love show up and still want to see you and read you and be a part of your intellectual and writing life. So Phil both does this sort of voluminous practice of research, and then he just sits down and writes every day. I've never known anybody who took portioning off his time as a writer more seriously than him. So for hours every morning, he's just in his office with the door shut, and he works until he feels like he can't work anymore today, and then he goes to the gym and teaches and does other things. But that commitment to every single day, no matter what the day of the week is, writing is, I think, Phil's biggest asset in terms of getting things done all the time.
Well, and by the way, not almost, not almost autistic. I'm somewhere on that spectrum. But
in like a really cool and fascinating way.
Yeah, no, it's a term of praise, if anything. But well, and hearing you describe it that way makes me almost wonder if that like horrible self-doubt is part of the process, because it I'm looking for an argument that I can make that's more fundamental than the argument I'm making. I don't know. Ashley's process, you need, first of all, you're a more compassionate person than I am, which means that you're more, it's easier for the world to get you to do things that aren't writing or like the theater work that you find joy in. If someone asks you to do some burdensome, miserable administrative task that will make the world like 1% better, you'll like hand wring a little bit and you'll end up doing it. Which means that you write most consistently when there's a sense of there's an assignment or a sense of like occasion about it. Like, you know, when Methuen came to you and said, will you write the book on prison theater around the world? Like, they kind of did you a favor, because you would not have taken seriously the idea that was something that you had the right to give yourself the time to do if you hadn't had that contract. Same thing with Plow asking you to. Ashley has this incredible piece about the late Russell Schoetz, who is a activist with the Black Liberation Army in Pennsylvania back in the 1970s, the Days of Rage era of American radical history, who hadn't really been written about. And she did months and months of in-depth interviewing and research and kind of made yourself sick working on it as hard as you did. But that, again, that was an assignment that someone else gave you. That allowed you to feel like, okay, I'm allowed to not to not be an administrator professor for a little bit, and I hope at some point you'll find a I don't know, the ability to like just let yourself be a writer artist for a while, because you know, I think you've got the chops, you deserve it. Another part of your process is that you're an incredibly conscientious, I've alluded to this already, but you're an incredibly conscientious researcher and interviewer. I think one of Ashley's strengths as a writer, and also one of the things that makes it very hard for her to fit into the journalism world, is that you do not approach things as a journalist. And even when you write as a scholar, you don't approach only as a scholar. It's you see yourself as... You usually see yourself as in some sort of relationship to the community that you're writing about. And like with the prison theater book, I mean, you foreground your own experience as somebody who was inspired to get involved in prison theater because of the unjust incarceration of your own father. Like, and your identity as a family member of a person in prison was also like, that's how you thought of yourself in relationship to Russell Schoetz's family. I'm not the interloping journalist who is coming in, parachuting into the story, to sort of sell it to a hostile public. I'm a member of this community. Like, I know what it's like to have your father, whisked away from you. And I think that gives your, that cuts down on what some traditional newsrooms would see as your objectivity, but I think it also intensifies the moral seriousness and commitment of your writing in a way that more than makes up for that. So I think your moral commitment to hearing everybody's stories and doing justice to everybody's stories, like, is part of what drives you when you're in an intense writing phase. And it also is part of what makes writing sometimes really hard for you, because you, in the same way that I just assume that everything I've written is crap, and all my friends in the group chats who are writers are going to be looking at it and going, Phil has finally low key fallen off, right? Your paranoia is instead that you will fail somehow in your ethical relationship to that community. Like, every writer has like the part of it that makes it almost undoably hard. And that's what it is for you. Is that a good description of your writing process? Yeah.
And I think the journalism point that you're making too, probably part of that is pacing as well, right? Like long form journalism, you'd probably fit right into that world. But, you know, when you're so dedicated to not just being an observer who's going to go out and talk about what someone else did, but like really understanding your subjects, that is really important. I love that. I love having you talk about each other's work. That's really cool. So both of you, I'm really curious about what your relationship is like to revision. Like, how do you work with revision?
I'm always grateful for the chance to be revising rather than writing something new. I always feel like it's exciting to get to the point where I can really think about what's there rather than having to put something there out of thin air. So revision is the happy part of writing for me.
I have two types of relationship to revision. One, everything I write, especially everything that I work really hard on, that I take really seriously or put a lot of myself into, there's a long phase of the writing where I am redoing the beginning like 50 times. And I've heard other people talk about doing the same thing. And I think it's almost like you're trying to find the doorway into the subject matter. You're like looking around for it. Somehow you're an intro allows you to try out like what your argument is going to be and the way the thing you're going to talk about and also the way that you're going to talk about it. It allows you to kind of try out all of those things at once. So I think that's why I do that. Like the beginning over and over again thing. And eventually I reach a point where I'm getting very frustrated because I have like 50 false starts. And at that point, if I'm smart, I'm kind of doing this right now with my third book. I just force myself to write like a certain number of words every day. And if they're garbage, then I just live with it. And just generate. And then as Ashley says, then you have a patient to operate on. And that is much more pleasant than having to like just produce something out of nothing. But yeah, sometimes my own perfectionism gets in the way of that. I reach a point where I needed to start generating 1,000 words a day of garbage a week ago, but it was too painful. I feel like those are the two main phases. And then there's like a third or fourth draft where, I clean everything up and I airlift everything, from the bad, messy drafts into a new document in a better order. It's like I have to get all the pieces right individually. And then there's like a real joy in seeing them in the right order. It's like a good dress rehearsal. Yeah.
How do you know when you have it?
He never does.
How do you know when you have it, Ashley?
Phil never does. And I usually have a deadline that makes me turn it in. And then you find out that the project lives somewhere else in some other form and the deadline was false anyway, or it was one version of what's happening and some other version has to come. So in part, it has to do with what is the piece supposed to do in the world? And have you reached the moment where addressing a public in a certain way is helpful?
How do you think about audience, speaking of addressing the public?
It depends on the work a lot. Academic writing is getting harder for me the older that I get because I'm not always sure who that public is. I'm not sure who's reading it or why or how I'm being most helpful to them. I'm looking more towards popular audiences now, in part because of the invitation that Phil was describing to write about Russell Maroon Schoetz. that piece was commissioned by Plow Quarterly while Maroon was still in prison, and he had served at that point 48 years, and had stage 4 colorectal cancer and had survived COVID. And his family wanted him to be able to come home and die in freedom. And they were looking for somebody to do a serious piece about his life and legacy that might help sway the tide of popular opinion in favor of bringing him home, whereas his public reputation has since the 70s been that he was a radical cop killer and a very dangerous person. So to think about what it means for a senior citizen to be slowly dying in prison is a very different image of a person than the young man who was involved in police killings as part of a radical racialized politics against police. And eerily similar to the kinds of battles we're seeing now about what it means for police to kill unarmed citizens, that was the exact kind of violence that Maroon was resisting in the 70s and in the late 60s. So it felt urgent in a very particular way, and I had to finish on deadline as quickly as possible because he was literally dying in prison. My piece was not the thing that brought him home, but was a contribution to decades of other people's activism to try to bring him home. But he did get to come home about 45 days before he passed away. So that was it brought a whole new level of urgency to the idea of writing that I had never had to live with before. But it did make me physically ill about 3 times trying to write this incredibly complex story about a very violent and unlikable man in many ways, who then had decades to grow into being a very different person who was hard to explain to a public who had had no access to him. So trying to think about, I think in my own writing and in a lot of other writing that I really like, how do we hold truths that are contradictory in the same space and honor all of the contradictions that are true about a given very difficult situation? And most causes for social justice are not as black and white as we would often like to paint them. We can't just throw our fists in the air and say, let's do the thing, let's march, let's whatever is supposed to happen, defund the police. Things that I really believe in are still very, very complicated when implemented. And we have to honor the complexity of how difficult justice is to find and uphold and maintain, instead of pretending that simple solutions are going to get us somewhere all by themselves. And that's I think what I'm really struggling with in my own mind and heart all the time. So that's what I want to write about. And that usually means that I can't write something short or fast.
Yeah, I am. Some of my writing, I'm thinking the audience I'm thinking about is it's almost like I'm gesturing at an audience that I want to exist. I have a book review column that I do regularly for Plow Quarterly, and like the public that I am imagining when I write that, like those pieces in particular, is something that neoliberalism wants to tell me can't exist, which is a really curious general audience that wants to hear about like major press and small press, scholarly and not and popular, like just anything that is good, they want to hear about it. I believe those people exist, but I don't think that anybody's addressing them as a unit. And so I'm trying to do that. It's like I'm trying to gesture an audience into existing. And then with some of my other stuff, I think a lot about a comment that Samuel Delaney made, that you should write as clearly as you can for the smartest person in the room. So on the one hand, like, you know, obfuscation that you can avoid. I mean, I do tend to think that's like almost kind of a sin. It's like you're either letting yourself get away with not formulating things as clearly or as honestly as you could, or you're trying to make people think you're smarter than you are. Like either way, ugh, yuck. But you never dumb down, because that's just a total slap in the face to your audience. I would rather err on the side of assuming too much, of asking too much of the audience than not asking anything at all. Because as a reader, I find it deeply I find the latter deeply disrespectful.
And how do you talk to your students about things like crafting an audience, things like holding two complicated ideas that might be contradictory together? Because I feel like one of the things that we're working with a lot of times with student work that we're trying to help students navigate is how to avoid the temptation to try to tie everything up in a tidy bow. And I'm curious about, you know, if you talk explicitly with your students about that, or if there's like an implicit way that you work through that with student creators, whether the writing is in prose or, you know, a play or a piece of criticism or, you know, or poetry, whatever it is. How do you think with students about those complexities?
I try to help students think about who they actually want to read the work and what those people know and don't know. Because a lot of times my students want to preach to the choir. They want to tell people that being in prison is a form of oppression, but they're writing for some folks in prison. And people in prison know that better than all of the rest of us. And they don't really need allies who just say, yes, you are oppressed, right? What people in prison tend to want is a way to be happy and a way to be joyful enough to stay alive in a really desperate situation. So they want to think complexly. They're perfectly capable of talking about very difficult things. But if your audience is somebody who already knows all the things you have to say to them, then that's not terribly interesting. But it's also really difficult if you don't try to figure out how much your audience actually does know, and you start talking about something that is totally out of context to people who have no way to situate what you have to say, then that's no good either. So trying to help people realistically receive the kinds of things that they want to say to the world. What would it take for you to understand this if you were coming to it totally new? And how do you edge your way into that conversation in a way that is an invitation and a welcome to people to think critically about really difficult ideas, but also pushing them to get to the point where they can hold two contradictory ideas or whatever that looks like. But also to think of audience very broadly, that to write for all of the people who have the privilege of coming to Literati tonight and people in prison as the same audience in some ways, that people who share common interests, people who want to talk about the same things, people who have the same capabilities is very realistic in many ways, and also a gift because it opens you up to a much wider community of readers and thinkers and people who you want to hang out with.
Yeah, Ashley always talks about how prison audiences are like the most rewarding audience because there's a genuine hunger for ideas. I feel like everyone is kind of sold, like Americans are sold on the idea that we should all be deeply, deeply anti-intellectual, and then people live down to that who don't actually need to. I've noticed that in the way that my students use the word pretentious. If I assign them an article that is well written, someone will call it pretentious. And even if you try to pursue, well, what does that actually mean in this context? What is the writer faking? In what way is the writer trying to appear more intelligent than they are? Well, I don't know, but you know, she mentioned cubism, and people don't know what cubism is. Yes, they do. They teach about cubism in 12th grade. Like, shut up. You know, like what? I don't tell my students
pedagogy
to shut up.
By Phil.
Yeah. I don't actually tell them to shut up. But the rest of that sentence was actually a pretty good representation of how I react. Like I try to make people conscious of the ways that they think we just do a certain amount of anti-intellectualism rotely and for no reason. And I think it's, I don't know exactly where it's comes from, but I think it's deeply, deeply sinister. and I really hate it. But then on the holding two truths at once thing, there is a whole unit of my first year course where like we self-consciously talk about and practice negative capability. F. Scott Fitzgerald Keats sense of like holding two ideas that don't quite fit with each other at the same time without like irritably trying to you know perfectly harmonize or resolve them. I tell them like I talk about that passage in that letter from Fitzgerald to his daughter where he talks about that and where he quotes Keats. And I say that I think that this, I mean, Fitzgerald says that that's what genius is. And whatever one's reaction to the word genius, I think it is I actually think negative capability is a practicable skill. Like once you know that that's a thing that people can do, you can just try doing it. And the way that I make them, do that is I make them read Annie Dillard because she's constantly contradicting herself. And her, like the students have so much trouble, like placing what her attitude is toward the stuff she says. And so I just make them live in her beautiful chaos for several weeks and I have them practice like actually writing, like we do imitation exercises, stuff like that. Like try looking at the world the way Annie Dillard looks at it, see what happens. And I get some really interesting arguments in the paper that results from that. Students, like if you ask them to be smart, they'll be smart. You know, if they know they're really being asked to be smart, and if they know that they're not also being if they know that you'll allow them to be messy on the way to that, that you will not be like spot checking every paragraph of every draft for typos, yeah, then they will live up to that. I think to an extent they like being treated like they're smart, you know, before they go off to, you know, be ground up by Ross for 3.5 years. I didn't say that.
So, I'm just looking at the time and I think I'm going to shift us. If this is your first time at Writer to Writer, what you may not know is that in the last 15 minutes or so, we like to give the audience a chance to ask questions, because your questions are going to be much more interesting than mine, I'm sure. And before we go there, we have a little gimmicky thing that we do, which I deeply enjoy and hope that you will too, which is that I have taken from inside the actor's studio the list of questions that James What's-His-Noodle lobs at everybody at the end. Yes. I can't think of his last name now.
Lipton,
thank you. Yes. Only I have adapted them, so they're more writing specific in many ways. So what I would love to do is just lob these questions at you and see what both of your answers are. And then we'll turn it over to the audience. Okay. All right, so what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would like to be a professional baker.
I'm kind of really curious about becoming a volunteer firefighter, but Ashley won't let me do it.
Oh.
He's a little clumsy. I think it would be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Fair. What profession other than your own is a hard no?
Anything to do with flying on airplanes all the time, because I get motion sickness.
I really suck at being in the same place 40 hours a week, which rules out a whole lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Who's your favorite writer?
Phil Chrisman.
Oh. Oh, now I feel like a giant jerk.
His favorite writer is Marilynne Robinson.
Ah.
Ashley and I have a bit where she pretends to be jealous of Marilyn Robinson.
Aww. I'm not pretending. If he ever disappears, I'm going to know where he went.
Love it. What's your favorite genre to write?
I think plays. I wish I had more time to get back to it, and I hope to do that again someday.
I didn't set out to become an essayist, but the kind of like personal but wide-ranging and also social essay, like that's turned out to be really fun. I'm a big fan of that form.
Nice. What's your favorite genre to read?
That's like asking about your favorite child. Yeah. I mean, I love to read plays. I love poetry. I love novels. I love cookbooks. I love nonfiction. I love all sorts of things.
Yeah, same thing. It's whatever I haven't read in a while, like practically speaking.
Nice. What genre that you haven't written yet would you like to try?
So many things, too many. I think it would be really fun to write a children's book. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be a lot of fun to write a cookbook. And I think it would be fun to write a novel. And I think it would be fun to write poetry. And there are all sorts of things I would like to do. Life is just not long enough.
I actually would really like to get back to writing fiction one of these days. I'm kind of waiting to have an idea that cannot be done except as a work of fiction. Like that, because I read too many novels where I'm like, this could have just been an essay. Like this wanted to be a personal essay because this person had some stuff they want to get off their chest. And so I'm trying to not do that. I would really like to write a novel.
Nice. What's your least favorite overused or misused word?
Elitist. I am so sick of the way that elitist gets used in American political discourse to basically punish anybody who is in favor of a politics that would overthrow our, like, the people who actually run the world. Like, if you are anti-capitalist, people call you an elitist. It's completely Orwellian. The whole notion, the idea that a barista who has blue hair and insists on being called they is they're a cultural elitist and some asshole who like lives on the profits from his investments and opposes anything that would help workers. He's a regular get down guy because he watches, because he attends an evangelical church and watches the same crappy TV as everybody else. No, he is the elite. Yeah. Like that just, it turns me into the Incredible Hulk.
I'm resisting the words prisoner and inmate and convict and things that feel like they're all in the same ballpark there. I would love for us to talk more about people who live in prisons, incarcerated people, people who've experienced incarceration, because that makes them people first and centers the idea that these are folks more like us than they are different, because that's the truth.
What's your favorite overused word that you use anyway? Even though you know it's overused.
I got a couple of these. One of my first year students just owned me to pieces. That's true. I love the adjective deeply. I'm always it's like my filler word. I overuse deeply.
It's a good word, so I can see why.
I'm not sure how much a word can be overused if it's a really good word. Like, I think I get in trouble, not in trouble, but I think sometimes it is unpopular that I use the word love as much as I do, that I tell my students that I love them, that I tell people who I do theater workshops with that I love them. Because It's true. Life is too short. And there are many kinds of love. That doesn't mean you're hitting on somebody or that it's sexual. Yeah. It just means that there is much love to be had in the world. And we need to not be afraid of it because it's a hard place out here and we need each other to survive.
Absolutely. And I think that if you and I use the word love way too much too. And I think for us, there's a gendered problem with that as well. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly if we use love, we're not as rigorous, we're not as smart, we're not as whatever, you know.
We're cute.
We're cute. Yeah, maternal. What gives you joy as a writer?
I find joy in having the privilege to write. That is part of my life, that's part of my job, that's part of what I get to do. I feel better when I'm writing more. I feel more accomplished and more myself and more at peace with the fact that I'm actually doing something. And when I'm not writing, I don't feel those things. So just having, and I think of so many people in desperate situations in the world who have fought for their right to be able to write, to be able to say what they mean, to not be censored, and to have the space and time to do that. That's huge. I feel so blessed to be a writer.
I find if I try to parody or mimic or like make fun of someone's style by inhabiting it, and if I can get it right, if I can find the right word that only they would overuse, like their equivalent of deeply, right? when I know that I've done that, it's such a good feeling. This is a goofy example, but on my Substack a couple of years ago, I did a post where it was this is such a niche joke, which is the only kind I tell, but the great contemporary theologian David Bentley Hart, it was if David Bentley Hart reviewed this was before Kanye went full Nazi, but remember when he did that? Remember when he dropped that gospel record that was like, it actually kind of sucked, but David Bentley Hart reviews the new Kanye. And I had his cadences right. His use of his addiction to the adjective holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, and the adjective beguiling. I managed to throw in a universal salvation argument. God will reconcile all things just as Kanye has brought the two members of Clips together. And I was laughing the whole time I was writing it. And I was like, 10 people are going to think this is funny, but it is going to make them laugh so hard that they will all need hernia surgery afterwards. And I was right. And that is just such a good feeling for me.
Oh, I love that. To bring us home, what three or four writers, living or dead, would you invite to an ideal writing retreat?
That's a hard one because some of the people whose writing you like the best might not be the people that you want to be on a retreat with all weekend. Like, I adore Joan Didion's writing, but I kind of think I'd be scared of her if I had to hang out with her in person. May she rest in peace. I would... Tennessee Williams would be a hoot, and that would be a lot of fun. I would love to size up Marilyn Robinson so that I could have a good look at my competition.
Separate retreats.
Yes, separate retreats. Phil can't come if Marilyn's coming. And I would love to hang out with Susan Laurie Parks, the playwright. She was my teacher when I was in college, and I was too young and afraid of her to spend as much time with her as I really wish I had.
I'm having so much envy right now.
Yeah, I might invite Susan Laurie Parks to my thing, too, because she seems pretty, in addition to being one of the, probably like, one of my top five living writers in the English language, she seems like she would be pretty chill and fun just from profiles and stuff and from what you've told me about her. I would actually not want Marilyn Robinson on my retreat because we would fight the whole time. My wife would get mad, but also we would fight the whole time about her complete, capitulation to like just defending everything that her good friend Barack Obama ever did, including the drone stuff and the failure to punish the banksters who caused the 2008 economic crisis. We would just get in a screaming fight about Bernie, and I've had enough of those. So yeah, and I love her, but no, platonically. So yeah, maybe Susan Laurie Parks. Dostoevsky is my other favorite writer of all time, and definitely, absolutely no way. He would just, if you brought Dostoevsky back from the dead, he would just rant about how Putin is right, and he would totally get involved in some Peter Thiel funded reactionary literary project, and probably he'd make a pest of him. He'd hit on the Red Scare girls. It would be awful. You know I'm right. Okay. Susan Laurie Parks, Renata Adler. I've heard she's actually way less scary in person than in print. So, probably her. And then probably just a bunch of people who I like and am friendly with, but haven't met in person. Like, I just want to get, you know, Becca Rothfeld and Vincent Cunningham and, my homies, in one place.
All right, so I'm going to step out into the audience with y'all, and we'll have just a couple of minutes for Q&A. Anybody have a question? They want to be the first? Okay. And then I'm coming to you.
This is a stupid question, but if you had to, go by fake name to, an author fake name, what would it be? I'm sure you've had to think about it.
I actually had to have a pen name once for a writing contest as an undergrad, and I sort of took from family name pieces. So my middle name is Elizabeth, so I called myself Liza, and then my mother's maiden name is Blankenship. So I was Liza Blankenship when I had to take a pen name.
I mean, I would actually be really curious about doing this, but I wouldn't actually do this because it would be like politically problematic. But it would be really interesting to see if I could just go by my initials and get people to think I'm a woman. Just, can I pull it off? Can I be convincing enough, you know? Or you, could I give rise to some funny Alice Tiptree type situation where, or James Tiptree, where people are like, oh, James Tiptree can't be a woman because he writes too much like a man. And then it turns out it's a woman. That's like my first thought, but I couldn't really do that because, you know, you're stealing valor from women writers. So I don't know. I don't know what my fake name would be.
So Ashley, you mentioned that you like revision. Do you think Chat GPT or any of these GPT type tools will play a role in helping overcome that? Because apparently their output is to be revised. And maybe you can talk about GPT in the context of teaching and undergraduate.
Yeah, I think Phil's going to have more. The types of assignments that he gives, I think, would cause him to have more challenges with students trying to fake things with ChatGPT, because most of the time I'm asking my students to write very personally about the experiences we have in making theater together, be it in prisons or in other social justice contexts. So you'd have to have a pretty extraordinary chatbot to know what we'd been up to be able to talk about it. But I think there was some major science fiction journal just shut down submissions because they were getting so many things written by chatbots, because all the sci-fi people were like, AI can write a whole story or a whole novel, and let's see what that's like. And the editor who gave an interview about that said it was just so horrible that it was the worst writing, that they actually stopped taking submissions from anybody because chatbots were so prevalent. I think you can't revise what doesn't have a heart to begin with. So for me, the process of revision to get to something that I'm actually proud of, or that I would be proud of with my students, would have to be responsive to what was not there in the ChatGP as a way to get started. I'm not saying that it couldn't be a useful tool to get people away from the blank page, because anything that gets you writing, I think, is a good deal, especially for inexperienced writers or young people. But to get to something that matters, you would have to find a heart where the heart doesn't exist. So you would have to pinpoint, what is it that really matters that was missing from the thing the computer spat at me?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. ChatGPT is a toy. If people understand that it's a toy, then I'm fine with it. And if you think it's going to replace the people who think it's going to replace writers, if anything, I think it's going to make us look more necessary. I'm increasingly unthreatened by it.
Well, and I will say that I do a fair amount of things in translation these days, and it's very apparent when Google Translate was the translator as opposed to a real person. And I have a feeling that we're going to have similar reactions to the stuff written by computers in a single language that we do to the nonsense that often comes out of anything complex that you're trying to translate with a computer.
One more question.
I want to build on the first audience question. What kind of piece that you think you might enjoy writing would drive you to write it under a pseudonym?
Oh, well, I've been begging Phil for years to write a really dirty romance novel under a pen name because I think it would sell. I mean, that 50 Shades of Grey stuff was dreadful, and Phil could make a fortune because he's such a great writer if he would just write something really dirty and put it out into the world, but I know he wouldn't want to do it in his name. So I think if he would just write some filth and put it out there, then we'd be rich enough to not have to worry about whatever else we wanted to do.
That's really funny because that was literally going to be my answer. I've been on too many church vestries to write porn, but I think I'd be good at it. I have two or three plots. Just going to say Joseph Cornell, Susan Sontag. I'm just going to let that float. Cause that did happen. I think I could do it, and not while my mother is alive.
Well, if you had a good enough pseudonym, she wouldn't have to know.
That's true. There you
go. The question I have is more relating to the classroom, more so towards like high school with like English classes, and you're expected to, they're trying to cram a bunch of genres into one year. Do you think we should still be just teaching theater in the awful way that we are? Or be, maybe this should, you know, just keep it in a separate class? It is still writing, but it's, you know, it's just not, I guess, is there maybe different theater that should be put front and center in that way?
Well, I have a deep and abiding love of Shakespeare, but I also have a bone to pick with the fact that bookstores and English syllabi from K through 12 all the way up through college, if they're only going to pick one piece of theater, they will just pick Shakespeare, or the whole theater section in most bookstores that are not theater specialty bookstores are almost entirely Shakespeare with almost nothing else in there. If we just said all poetry is Homer and walked away from it, people would be in an uproar. If we just, well, except for Dan. But there's so much good work out there. And I think that a lot of people who have not had exposure to the theater, particularly exposure to seeing it as opposed to reading it, have a tendency to believe that theater is somehow television live, which is really reductive and just not true, and denies thousands of years of really fascinating theater history. But all kinds of literature are sort of like that that Oliver Sacks book that got turned into a movie about the people who have dementia who sort of wake up when they hear the music that they like best, Awakenings. It was a movie. But he discovered in treating these dementia patients that if you played the right music, the music that that person loved, it would cause them to have movement and intellectual stimulation and all of these things again. But if you just played music in general and you didn't find their heart, then it didn't work. And I think theater is like that. So if Shakespeare is the thing that wakes you up, then that's the thing that you need to get to the party. But for a lot of other people, it might be Dominique Morisseau or Susan Laurie Parks, or it might be something a lot more experimental and out there. And all of that should be loved and embraced, because the thing we need is to get people excited about reading and performing, to have a true love for the arts and a love for the print and spoken word. So I think we need all of it. And a lot of it is the trick of knowing your audience. Again, we talked about audience earlier, but if you live in a local community that has some shared interests, a hook might be to talk about that particular community and use it as a lead-in to all sorts of other things that people might love.
I wouldn't say thank you so much to both of you for coming. This has been such a wonderful conversation. I feel like I've learned a ton. Thank you to the audience also for coming. I know it's hard to do when we've just come back from spring break, so we appreciate you, and thank you so much.